If you've ever experienced a flash of sadness or even pity at seeing a blind person, that might change after you've read Isaac Lidsky's new book, Eyes Wide Open, just out from Tatcher Peregrie. You may remember him from when he starred as Weasel in the television sitcom Saved by the Bell, but he's accomplished quite a bit in his life since then, despite or even perhaps because of becoming blind at the age of 25. And I'm very pleased to welcome Isaac Lidsky to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard. It's so great to be here. Thank you.
You write that sight is much more than meets the eye. That's a clever turn of phrase, but what do you mean by it?
Sure. So, you know, I grew up with normal sight, and I think like most people, I thought that sight was something passive. You know, you open your eyes, you perceive the world, and it's objective truth, it's reality. There's not much more to it. In fact, sight is this virtual reality that is masterfully constructed by our brains, but is nothing like objective or universal truth. It implicates all sorts of facets of our lives. It impacts and is impacted by our memories, our opinions, our emotions, our conceptual knowledge, and on and on and on. And I literally saw this as I lost my sight progressively over about a dozen years.
How old were you when you first learned that you were going to lose your sight?
I was diagnosed when I was 13 years old. I was told that I had retinitis pigmentosa.
Was this in the family?
Yeah, well, so it's a genetic condition. Each of my parents is a recessive carrier of the disease, but neither of them has it. But two of my three older sisters and I got the condition.
At the time, you thought it was just an issue of your sister Daria.
That's exactly right. What landed us in the ophthalmologist's chair was my sister Daria was having some issues with her sight, and we went to the ophthalmologist's office, and then he told my mom to take all of the kids to the sort of medical center, the research center at the big university in town. So off we all went for a day of strange tests.
And what do issues with her sight mean?
So she had started bumping into things more frequently, some bumps and bruises, some scares, some tragedy nearly avoided. And, you know, at first you kind of thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, she's sort of a little clumsy. But you know, then it became clear it was a bit more than that.
And did the doctor give any indication of how long it would take before you'd lose your sight?
No, the doctor said to me, you'll progressively lose your sight and go blind. I can't tell you how long it will take. There are no treatments. There are no cures. We don't know much about the disease. Good luck.
How rare is retinitis pigmentosa?
It's pretty rare. I mean, it's among a family of diseases that afflict, I think, 6 or 7 million folks in the United States. But RP itself is far fewer. But it came out of nowhere.
So when you heard that you were going to eventually lose your sight, what did you fear most about that?
So when I was diagnosed, I knew that blindness was going to ruin my life. I knew it. I thought it was a death sentence for my independence and achievement. And I thought it meant that I would live a, you know, small and unremarkable life.
And what was it like when you were writing this book and thinking back to that time?
So writing the book was an amazing experience for me. It was a very intense experience. I'm very passionate about sharing the vision that I gained through blindness. And, you know, I basically relived a lot of my life in the writing. A lot of joys and triumphs, but also a lot of pain and anxiety and fear. So it was cathartic.
But you also got involved in the world of entertainment. How old were you when that began?
Yeah, so I grew up acting as a kid. I did about somewhere between 100 and 150 commercials. And ultimately, you know, one thing led to another, and I was cast as Weasel Wiesel on the NBC sitcom, which I mentioned. But I left that world behind around the time I got the diagnosis.
But you'd already enjoyed some celebrity. You were kind of famous during the Saved by the Bell days.
Yes, sure. I had the Hollywood experience of fan mail and getting recognized and publicity tours and all that. In those days, like I said, I thought blindness was going to ruin my life, and I was in
and
a
you
real
would
hurry.
End your career.
Yeah, I was in a rush to move on from L.A. to squeeze as much as I possibly could into my life before, you know, the curtain fell.
What were you hoping for during the time that you and your parents were pushing for research and involved in founding Hope for Vision? Was that a way of playing into a sense of denial?
There's no doubt. So, I mean, I don't regret for a second, you know, our work to support the research. I still would love to see, and the brilliant scientists have my respect and admiration. But in many ways, I thought I was confronting blindness, but I was running away from it. I was committed to this narrative that blindness is death, and we've got to find a cure in time, because otherwise, it's just too horrible to even imagine.
And even now, it's unclear, other than there's a genetic component.
So the science has come a long way in the 24 years or so. They're very close to several avenues of treatment.
You report some strange mishaps you had as your sight was deteriorating.
Yeah, so as I sort of lost the photoreceptor cells of my retina, if you sort of picture the bulbs of a Jumbotron sort of scoreboard or screen in an arena, and you imagine the bulbs breaking sort of slowly and randomly over time, that's kind of how my sight degraded over about a dozen years. And yeah, I thought I saw one thing, and then gained some information or felt it, or a friend would tell me what it was, and then it suddenly became something else, and things just appeared and morphed, and I was a sort of conscious and active participant in the experience of sight. It was interesting, but what that gave me was just a profound insight into our immense power to shape the reality we experience. It's a power we don't necessarily realize we have, but I was blessed to see that we have it.
Is that how you came to graduate from Harvard magna cum laude, and no less at the age of 19?
Yes. So I credit really the vision, the insights that I gained as a result of blindness with much of the joy and fulfillment and success in my life. It turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. That said, I wrote the book because it's really not about blindness or sight. It's about understanding our roles in choosing how we want to live our lives in every moment.
Did fear propel you to rush into your pursuit of a degree? Is that why you went to college so young?
Yes, exactly. I was in a hurry. I had this feeling that I was living a race against the clock. I was on the sidelines kind of watching the struggle between blindness and science. And I was eager to get as much into my life as I could as quickly as possible until I learned to see through my fears, of course.
What career did you envision for yourself when you were at college?
I think I was pretty certain I would be a lawyer like my father.
So you studied law?
I did wind up studying law with a sort of brief interlude in between, but I've been blessed to have a lot of experience. Law, business, and entrepreneurship, internet startup, and now I run a construction company. So there's been many chapters in my life. Again, I think in many ways the greatest chapter was ultimately kind of going blind and learning how to take control.
My guest is Isaac Lidsky, who's written a memoir called Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities in a World That Can't See Clearly. And you're comfortable using the word blind. Some people who lose their vision find that word demeaning.
Huh. Yeah. It takes a lot to bother me or to offend me. I got to be honest. I don't take much too seriously. And I'm blind. It's funny that you mentioned that, because sometimes I experience folks, acquaintances, people I'm newly meeting, hostess in a restaurant, really just struggling to come up with a way to put together a string of words to convey the idea that I can't see. And sometimes I'll even just chime in and say, I'm blind. Like, it's okay. You can say it.
Tell us about that startup you mentioned, originally called RU4.com.
Yes. So my brother-in-law and I, in 1999, started an internet advertising technology company, kind of at the height of the internet bubble. And just after we started it, that bubble burst violently. And we had a rough couple of years turning that company around, but we were ultimately successful.
But then you went back to law school?
Yeah. So when we finally raised some institutional money and hired our own bosses, and it kind of started to look more like a real job, I went on to law school, which I kind of had always intended to do, to go on to study law. And I wasn't looking for a real job.
Why did one of your law school professors, Charles Nesson, suggest that your blindness could be an asset in a career as a trial lawyer?
So in many ways, he was right. My blindness often helps to break down kind of barriers of formality or distance between me and others. There's kind of an inherent vulnerability, and I'm very comfortable with that vulnerability. And as a result, I enjoy a connection with folks that, you know, again, I think is a real blessing born of my blindness. Professor Nesson thought kind of more specifically in the arena of litigation, trying to convince a jury. He said, you know, if you can work your blindness there in the courtroom,
they'll feel sorry for you.
Yeah, they'll be amazed. They'll feel a bond. They'll feel bad for you. They'll connect with you. And as a result, they'll listen to you.
Now, you also clerked, you were a Supreme Court law clerk under not only Sandra Day O'Connor, but also Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and that was an awesome experience.
You must be quite proud of the fact that you're the only blind person to have clerked for the court. How did you wind up doing that? What were your initial interviews with them like?
So, you know, it's funny. I wish I weren't the only blind clerk.
Oh, there have been others?
No, there have not been others. Oh. I wish there were others. It shouldn't be an impediment to clerking for the court. But no, you're right. At the time, I could boast that I clerked for every female justice in the history of the court.
Uh-huh. And that was just coincidental?
Well, I guess in a sense, I was hired by Justice O'Connor, who had retired from the court but still served judicial function in the sort of lower appellate courts of appeal and wrote speeches and books. And so I traveled with her, did a lot of work for her. And then she followed the tradition of loaning me to an active justice at the court for the term. So, you know, the first week on the job, Justice O'Connor called me into her office and said, "Now, Isaac, you know, how would you like to work for Ruth this term?" So I said, "Sure, let's do it."
They're very strong women, but are they very different? Or was it, did you feel like you were working in very similar circumstances?
No, totally different. Totally different personalities, totally different jobs.
What sorts of cases did you argue in federal court on behalf of the United States?
Oh, so, well, back when I was a litigator for the Justice Department, all sorts of stuff. It was a really neat job. I worked for the appellate staff of the Civil Division. It's in many ways the best job I've ever had. I got to represent the, you know, Drug Enforcement Administration. I got to represent the Department of Education, the United States itself. All sorts of agencies. Really interesting cases.
So you did a lot during your 8 years in law.
Yes,
it was. But then why did you leave it behind?
So kind of the end of the road for me was accepting the sort of posh, fancy, elite law firm job working for a big international law firm. And while many people enjoy that path and are good at it and find rewards, it wasn't for me at all. And part of the Eyes Wide Open sort of vision I gained is really to hold yourself accountable for what your definition of success and value is and kind of what's important to you in your life. So putting my money where my mouth is, I decided to make a change.
And you went into business.
I did. I ditched my legal career and with my college roommate acquired a small, struggling residential construction subcontractor in Orlando. And Leonard, I can tell you my parents thought I had lost my mind.
Well, it did cost $15 million, didn't it?
Oh, well, that was the revenue of the business in its first year of operation.
Is that okay? Is that good for a subcontractor, $15 million?
You know, it is what it is. It was a decent-sized business in our industry, in our market at the time. It was a far less healthy company than we thought we were buying. My roommate kept his fancy day job in finance. I quit mine and took the helm. And shortly after taking over the company, learned that it was really in a tailspin. But we were blessed with a phenomenal team of people. And over the last 5 or 6 years, they have exceeded my wildest dreams for the company, and now it's about 10 times the size, and more importantly, it's profitable.
Did you ever think of going back into acting?
No, not really.
Because there are roles for people who have in your situation.
Well, I'll tell you, if I were going to play a role, it would be a sighted person. I would be interested in doing that. It's fine. I get the remark from people all the time. Aren't you really blind? You don't look blind. You make eye contact and this and that. And I play a sighted person.
When did you meet your wife, Dorothy?
Dorothy. Dorothy and I met my first year of law school at Harvard was her senior year at Harvard College. And we met through some mutual friends.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that she compliments you?
Oh, absolutely. She compliments me. She's I have nothing and am nothing that I do not share with her, and I wouldn't want it any other way.
How did your vision loss ultimately break open your heart, as you say?
Yeah, so in my kind of youth, I was sort of really into being hyper-rational and thinking logically, and wasn't a big fan of dwelling on emotions, and kind of jammed a lot of that stuff down. Much as going blind sort of shattered the illusion of sight for me, it also shattered this notion that that we can live sort of entirely rational lives, or even that our thoughts and ideas are exclusively rational. And I kind of was exposed to the realm of the heart as I saw friends and family support our cause to try to raise research funding, and it wound up being a great asset in my life.
Do you have to contend with people having misconceptions about you?
Sure. And, you know, we all do it. We all have misconceptions, frankly, about ourselves and certainly about others. So it's something we all confront. As a blind man, I confront others' assumptions about my life every day.
You have a set of triplets.
I do.
Did that come as a surprise? Also, another daughter?
Exactly right. So, the triplets were was the biggest surprise of our lives. Dorothy and I went to get an early pregnancy scan to ensure that the heart of our child, singular, was growing, and found out it was triplets. So, and then they have a baby sister, Clementine, as well.
And parents often fear unpredictable disasters that they can't control with children. Doesn't blindness kind of compound that?
You know, almost to the contrary, you know, again, going blind really showed me that, you know, all of us are making the choice in every moment how we want to live our lives, you know, and who we want to be. And we can do that with awareness and accountability, or almost by default and happenstance. And the vision, sort of seeing what I see and the way I'd live my life, fear is not something I try to spend a lot of time dealing with. I try to see through fear and enjoy the reality I want to create for myself.
You haven't written this book as a traditional memoir. Why not?
So the book, it's not a memoir. It's also not a book about, you know, blindness or disability or even just overcoming challenges. I mean, I gained my vision, my philosophy, by going blind. I am certain to my core that it is a philosophy, it is a way to live life that is has immense promise for folks. I've lived that promise. I wanted to share it with others. I wanted, frankly, to put it down on paper and words for my children, for my family. And my passion now, my calling really is to share this with others because, again, I got it through my unique experiences, but it's applicable to all of us. We all confront our own, self-limiting assumptions, feelings of sort of surrender, misconceptions about what we tell ourselves our weaknesses are, our insecurities. And of course, we all face challenges and fear. And anyway, it's a real joy for me to be able to share this vision with others.
Did you always know you'd call it Eyes Wide Open?
You know, it seemed like a pretty good title. Mm-hmm. if you pardon the pun, going blind was eye-opening for me. It really was.
Isaac Litsky will appear at the Rubin Museum of Art for the talk How to Perceive Without Sight, along with neuroscientist Jacqueline Gottlieb, this Saturday the 18th from 6 to 7:30. For information on tickets, you can go to our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. The book, Eyes Wide Open, is published by Tarcher but whatever it is, Isaac, thank you so much for having been on our show today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. It's my honor. I appreciate it.